About 6 months ago, I came across an article by Sefu Bernard, who works for the Washington Mystics and the Toronto Raptors. The title of the article was High Performance Teams Are Not a Family. And when I read the title, I thought, now wait a minute. My experience in sports and coaching and playing is that one of the most common analogies that we use for being part of a team is that it should feel like a family. It should feel like everybody belongs, that everybody has a role, that everybody has value, that no matter what, you belong here. And yet, as I read through Sefu's article, he makes a very interesting point that I think is true in all of our team context here, is that while we want our teams to feel like a family, high-performance sports is very conditional. In other words, in a family, when you sit down at the dinner table, everybody eats, and typically everybody has dibs on the same amount of food. However, on a high-performance team, when we're talking about playing time, not everybody gets to eat. Not everybody eats the same amount. And so, as coaches, it can become very difficult to communicate with players and with parents and to establish standards that, on the one hand, we want to build a culture of belonging and togetherness, but at the same time, if you're coaching a high-performance team, you have to play your best players to have the best chance to win. So this week's conversation is going to be a little bit about playing time, a little bit about establishing and enforcing behaviors, a little bit about entitlement, and how, as coaches, do we navigate this dichotomy of wanting to build, on the one hand, a culture of belonging, and on the other hand, making sure that every role is earned.
You're listening to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin alongside my co-host, Nate Sanderson. Every week in around 30 minutes, we're giving you strategies and tools for you to grow as a leader and build your culture. We know the reason why most teams struggle, and that is because they have a dysfunctional culture. This leaves coaches frustrated with entitled players, losing seasons, and toxic environments. And at Thrive on Challenge, we believe that the silver bullet is a transformational culture. We help coaches to create and sustain transformational cultures so they can strengthen relationships, raise standards, and inspire others to make an impact. To learn more about our workshops, retreats, and mentorship program, go to thriveonchallenge.com. You can also get the coaching notes PDFs for every Coaching Culture episode by subscribing to our weekly newsletter. You're listening to episode 134. How to create a culture where everything is earned and it feels like family. So Nate, coming back to the introduction there that you kind of shared with us some of those thoughts, you know, those really resonate with me because I've definitely been that coach where I want to create a family-like atmosphere within our team. But at the same time, I know that it doesn't operate that way. I mean, I've used that cliche around family, just like most coaches out there. We've broken plenty of our team huddles with a 1-2-3 family. We've put the family on the back of our t-shirts. I know that Nike put family on the back of every basketball team's t-shirt in the country this year. And there's always been something about that use of the word family, though, that just hasn't sat right with me. And it's really hard to articulate this dilemma that we face as coaches when we're trying to create that culture where people feel like they belong. And we want people to know that they're valued not because of their performance, but just because of who they are as a person. But at the same time, we have to assign certain value to the players when it comes to deciding their roles and playing time, which is obviously such a hot topic when it comes to our culture, and people feel like they're valued, right? So often they feel like they're valued based upon their role or their playing time. And so, how do we articulate that dilemma to our players is really challenging.
Well, JP, before we get into solutions here, I want to share a couple of analogies that we've used with our players and our parents just to try to illustrate the conflict or the challenge that we experience as coaches trying to figure this out. Because ultimately, what we're talking about here essentially boils down to playing time a lot of the time, right? If you think about a family where everybody eats because they're part of the family, in sports, not everybody plays just because they're part of the team. Even if they do everything that they're asked to do, it just doesn't work that way. And one of the analogies that we've used with our parents last year at a parent meeting was we put a pizza up on the a picture of a pizza with eight slices up on the screen. I said, if you imagine the 35 players in our program, they're all out because they love pizza. They're here because they want to eat pizza. But our challenge is we only have eight pieces of pizza to distribute. Now, in the room, we might disagree about the best way to distribute that pizza. Some might believe the oldest player should eat first, or the best player should eat the biggest slices, or some might believe everybody should get at least a little piece of pizza just because they're on the team. Other people might say, you know what? You have to earn the right to eat pizza. And that might mean only eight people eat pizza and 27 watch them eat. But ultimately, in a competitive team environment, not everyone is going to get to eat pizza. And ultimately, that means that those that don't are going to be disappointed. Their parents are likely to be disappointed. Some of the kids that get smaller slices of pizza are likely to be disappointed. And the challenge for us as coaches then is, how do we communicate how we choose who's going to get what parts of the pizza? Now, another challenge that's different for sports than, say, the classroom is that in the classroom, when the syllabus goes out at the beginning of the year, the standards are set. And every person in that class that meets the standards can get an A. Now, it doesn't happen very often, but it's certainly possible that 20 people in a single classroom could all walk away at the end of the semester with an A if they've done all the work that was assigned. In sports, that doesn't exist because we have a finite number of A's. So you might do all of the work, you might do all of the assignments, but if I only have five A's to give out, there's 15 people that are not going to get that grade. And ultimately, the challenge is at the end of the semester, we're only going to give out five A's. And numbers 6 through 10 in that class are going to get B's. And they're going to be disappointed, and 11 through 15 are going to get C's. But we have to be able to communicate, how did we determine who got an A, who got a B, who got a C, et cetera, and try to create an environment where everybody still wants to be in the class. Now, when we talk about this sense of disappointment, one of the buzzwords that you hear all the time with coaches, and JP, you and I hear this from coaches we work with all the time, is this sense of entitlement, right? That there's this feeling that, well, my kid should play, or I want to play because I love basketball, because I put the time in, or whatever the reasons might be. And typically we run into those excuses when they haven't been able to earn the spot that they want.
Now, those are two great metaphors that I think we can use to help articulate the reality or the challenges that we face in that decision as a coach. I want to circle back to something you said a little bit earlier in your kind of pizza metaphor. And it comes back to this idea around of entitlement. I think there's three predominant groups of entitlement in today's sports culture. The first off is the entitled athlete that believes they should play because they're talented. They don't have to work hard. They shouldn't have to have a good attitude. They should just be able to show up and get on the court or get on the field. The second group is the player that shows up, works hard, has a good attitude, and they think that is good enough for them to be able to play on game day. They don't have to be good. They just showed up and they worked hard and they feel like they've earned that spot. Probably the most frustrating group is the third group that we face as coaches. And that is the group that they don't show up, work hard, or have a good attitude. And they're not even talented. They just feel that they're on the team, they're wearing a jersey, and that should be good enough for them to play. And that causes a lot of frustration, not just for us as coaches, but I actually think that it creates conflict within your team culture. Let me explain. Many of the programs that I've worked with and supported in the last few years, there's a dynamic that exists between the players and also, and especially high school programs, the players' parents, where they become resentful of each other. You've got the talented player that just feels like, well, why is this other guy playing? He's not good enough, all right? But that player may be giving great effort. They may be executing. They may be bought into all those culture things. And for that reason alone, they may actually help you or may help put you in the best position to win having them on the court. The other side of that is you get the players that work hard and have a good attitude, and they can often become resentful of those players that play over them because they're not doing those intangibles or they're not that as committed as they are. And so that's something we need to really be aware of, is that dynamic does exist. and we need to be addressing those issues.
JP, I know we want to be careful about this episode just becoming a rant on entitlement or entitled players, but I do like Mark Manson's definition in his book of entitlement as this feeling as though somebody deserves good things or they deserve what they want without actually having to earn them. I think to a John Beck tweet that I read a couple of months ago about entitlement, and I'm gonna just read it kind of verbatim here because he really shows a lot of the symptoms of this mentality. And he says, players, entitlement isn't attractive. You appear entitled if you think coaches should do any of the following things: lower standards, accept laziness or mediocrity, give you what you haven't earned, reward you for simply showing up, accept your excuses, treat you differently than your peers, or put your individual wants before the team. And ultimately, when you start looking at those different manifestations of this sort of entitlement mentality, it comes down to the coach, the responsibility of the coach, to be able to establish and communicate, this is how playing time is going to be earned.
So when it comes to communicating how players' roles are determined and how playing time is dished out here to our players, I see coaches fall into two big traps. And I've had the fortune to be able to go and work with so many programs across the country. And one of the things that I often do is I send out feedback forms to the players, and if it's a high school program, to the parents. And one of the most consistent complaints when it comes to their perspective of the culture and the job that the coaches are doing is a lack of transparency or a lack of understanding around their role or how their playing time is decided. And I think in all those cases, coaches have been trying to communicate that. They have been making an effort in that, but we're still falling short. And there's two big things that I think we fall short on. The first is when we are sitting down with a player and we're giving them that talk about where they are on our team, I think sometimes we try to soften the blow a little bit. And when we make an effort to soften that blow, we leave out some of the truth that they need to know about where they are with their ability. And that's what's keeping them from being able to be on the court or on the field. And I think we have to be really, really truthful in that and really, really transparent as far as where we see them. And so often we don't do that. The second big area I see coaches make a big mistake on is we communicate that playing time comes down to some sort of equation. And in that equation, often I'll see coaches talk about, you know, certain skills or their tactical skills, but they're often coaches are putting in, we're going to play the people that work hard and have a good attitude. And when we throw that in the equation, we really mess up the perception around how playing time is going to be deciphered, because that's not really what decides our playing time. And I think in the culture that I want to build and the culture I want to build for help other coaches build, it is a culture where players have to meet a certain standard to be on that program. They have to have a good attitude. They have to work hard to be a part of the practice, right? I talk about a good deal when it comes down to transformational discipline, maintaining standards in your program, in your practice, on your bench, on the court, on the field, wherever it be, that there's this minimum standard that every player must meet. But after that, to be on the court or be on the field, to be playing in the game, it's going to come down to those players that are going to give us the best chance to win. And I think that we often really shy away from that because we think we're sacrificing our values with that type of approach. And we don't have to sacrifice our values in that approach. And I think if we can clear up that message in that case around that playing time equation, I think we're going to save ourselves from a little bit of heartache that we run into throughout the season.
So JP, I think a great analogy for that, going back to what we started with, this idea of family being different than team because of that fact that you just described there, is it's a lot like going to the amusement park. You know, I remember when I was a kid and we went on vacation in Brainerd, Minnesota, and our family went to Paul Bunyan Land, and everybody got to go. All my cousins got to go. Everybody got to go into the amusement park. But it wasn't till I was a certain age, really a certain height, that I got to ride the roller coasters, because there's a little wooden bear sticking his finger out. And until my head was above that finger, I wasn't able to go on the ride. And in a lot of ways, what I'm describing here is two different thresholds of participation, right? When we think about that in what you've described here, I love using the word eligibility. You have to establish that you are eligible to play. When we talk about that in terms of academic eligibility, everybody accepts that, right? You have a minimum GPA, you have to be passing your classes, whatever those standards are. And once you're academically eligible, then you can compete to be able to play, right? If you're not passing your classes, it doesn't matter how good you are, in most cases, you're not going to be able to play until you raise your grades. Well, if you think about that same method applied to your cultural standards, there's a standard of eligibility, of working hard, of being a good teammate, you know, carrying yourself respectably in the community, whatever those things might be for your culture, that has to be met in the same way that an academic standard has to be met in order to be eligible to compete to play. And the second threshold then is, based on what you're talking about here, is your performance, right? So if you're a great player, as you talked about before, you're a talented player, but you don't work hard, or you're a jerk in the locker room, or you're a cancer on the team, in this language, you would be ineligible because you don't meet the cultural standards. You're not going to play. I don't care how good you are. And at the same time, if you're a player that shows up in the offseason and they work hard and they're a great teammate and they're selfless, you know, they put the team first, you've met the standard of our culture to be eligible to play. But if you are not one of the best 7 or 8 players based on your performance, which again assumes that all the other players are also meeting that standard of cultural eligibility, you're probably not going to play either, because it's based on performance. It's simultaneous thresholds. In the same way that I had to get in the station wagon and go to Paul Bunyan Land, and I also had to be taller than that bear to ride the roller coaster, your players have to meet those cultural standards and performance standards in order to get the playing time that they want.
So this idea, or this concept around presenting essentially two thresholds to our players, it sounds really, really simple, but the reality is we could communicate that. We could communicate at the beginning of the year or even throughout the year, but that is not going to be enough for most players. We have to do more things, I think, to really help them to understand, to appreciate that, and be intentional in supporting them in this kind of this system that we're presenting to coaches, right?
Well, JP, I think there's really three keys to being able to make this work with your players and being able to communicate it effectively with them and with their parents and with your administrators. And number one, it requires radical transparency. In other words, your players have to know exactly what the cultural standards are that they're being held accountable to become eligible. And you know, we've done a number of conversations on how that process can work to agree on what those standards are, what they should look like. But they have to know, right? That's only fair. And the second piece of that is you have to be really transparent with what your performance standards are. What is it that you are comparing player A and player B when it comes to their performance? You know, it's not good enough just to say, well, we're going to play the better defender. Well, what does that mean? Is that on-ball defense? Is it help side defense? You know, there's lots of things that go into that. You've got to be able to communicate exactly what it is that you're evaluating. The second thing is it requires objective feedback. So you have to be able to tell a player, this is where you are. If you're the ninth man, you're the 10th man, whatever it might be, so that there isn't confusion where they think that they should be starting, but they're not, and they can't figure it out, or they should be playing and they're not. You have the honest conversation, and it's an ongoing conversation. And the second piece of that is you have to be able to give them objective feedback as to how they can get better, without making a promise that it's going to lead to more playing time. Because again, as we've talked about, the equation for playing time is not just one player's effort or one player's performance. It's in comparison with everybody else. But you have a responsibility to help every player to be able to improve during the course of the year. And you have to be willing to have those ongoing conversations as well. The third piece that probably makes or breaks this as a system for you is you have to be able to build trust. Your players have to trust that you're going to make the right decision. And that means that when you have a talented guy who has a bad practice or doesn't work hard or is moping on the bench, they're no longer culturally eligible. You can't play them. Even if it means you're going to lose a game, even if it means you're not going to be as competitive, you have to stick to the standard, right, that you set for the team. In the same way, your favorite player, your own son, might be the best culture guy you've ever had, but if they're not good enough compared to the other people performance-wise who are culturally eligible, you can't play them if that's going to be the standard. And so that credibility, that trust is built with consistency over time. You making consistent decisions, your players can learn to rely on your judgment and know that you're going to be faithful to the standards that the team has set for themselves, both culturally and performance-wise.
So I think this is potentially the hardest thing in coaching today to get right, because I think so often we sacrifice our credibility because we're unwilling or we're afraid to have those hard conversations and make those hard hard decisions. And it's because it is really, really challenging. I remember 5 years ago, I made a choice that I was not going to play players that weren't meeting that minimum criteria. And I remember one player in particular, the first half of the year was really struggling to buy into our cultural standards. And he was sitting out, I was having him sit out various drills and he sat out a few practices. And because of that, he was not playing in certain games. And I remember one game, due to an incident in the practice the day before, he was not only not starting, he wasn't going to play at all. And I let him know that. Well, I remember he texted his mother just before the game was taken off. And as I'm headed into the locker room, his mother, you know, approaches me, is in my face right in front of the entire stands there, chewing me out. How could I not play her son? I'm an idiot. We're going to lose the game because I'm not going to play her son. And she was right. We needed her son to be competitive. And we went out there, we got our butts whooped. You know, and I had not only to have to deal with that, but there were certain players in the team were like, "Coach, we need him. You know, we need this guy." And so you're going to get resistance from parents. You might get resistance from administrators, from fans, from your players may even say, "Coach, we need this person. You can't do this." But I can attest to this, that it's that persistence, that courage to be able to make those hard decisions, that ended up helping this kid turn things around. You know, and it won't always be that case. Sometimes we're going to be putting our job on the line. I know coaches that have gone through that. And so we make these suggestions. I just want to share this with the listeners, is we're making these suggestions knowing that this is really, really hard. But honestly, it could be one of the most important things and the most important battles that you take on as a coach.
You know, JP, you and I both know from our own experiences and working with coaches and observing other programs that when the standards begin to change, you're going to experience resistance. And the other thing that you're going to see is that people are going to leave. Players may choose to go somewhere else. You may have coaches that are not on board with how you want to grow the program. And I just finished reading The MVP Machine, talking about the Houston Astros and how they changed their scouting and their player development to be more about analytics and that sort of thing. But their traditional scouts and coaches, they left or they were asked to leave because they wouldn't buy into the new standards for development and evaluation. And in fact, the general manager told the authors of the book that 4 years after starting this process, 90% of their front office was different, but that their organization had never been healthier. And when I think about my experiences in building programs, when you get to the point where the standards are so firm, they're so strongly established, that players begin to self-select themselves out of the culture because they don't fit, they don't want to meet the cultural standards, they don't want to compete for playing time. Really, that's the turning point in your program. That's when the culture becomes self-sustaining. And it's a hard price to pay, and it hurts when people leave. But at the same time, this is when you know your standards have been established. And until that point, it feels like you're pushing a boulder uphill. And oftentimes, it feels like other people are pushing back. But it's worth the effort to climb.
And so, coaches, this is the purpose of our mentorship program. Yes, there is a consulting type aspect to it of helping you to implement systems and strategies, to build your team's culture. But we understand from our experience and the experience of so many coaches that we've worked with, that pushing that boulder up the hill we need help in that process. We need somebody there alongside of us. We need a sounding board, and that's what we provide for coaches. That's why so many coaches not only have been in the program, but continue to stay in the program. And so if you've put off scheduling that call to talk with Nate or I, don't wait any longer. Schedule a call today. I'm putting a link in the episode details. Let's connect. Tell us what's going on with your team and see if we might be able to help you out this upcoming season.